Welcome to the College Commons Podcast, passionate perspectives from Judaism's leading thinkers, brought to you by HUC Connect, the Hebrew Union College's online platform for continuing education. I'm Joshua Holo, your host. Welcome to this episode of the College Commons Podcast and our conversation with Tomer Persico. Tomer Persico is a research fellow at the Shalom Hartman Institute and a senior research scholar at the UC Berkeley Center for Middle Eastern Studies. In addition to hundreds of articles on social and political issues in Israel, he has written three books: The Jewish Meditative Tradition in 2016, In God's Image, Selfhood, Freedom, and Equality, which came out in Hebrew in 2021, and Liberalism, Its Roots, Values, and Crises in 2024. His second book came out in translation by NYU Press in 2025 under the title In God's Image, How Western Civilization Was Shaped by a Revolutionary Idea. Tomer Persico, thank you for joining us on the College Commons Podcast.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Start us off, if you would, with a thumbnail of your book, In God's Image, and its central claim.
So really, the book is an intellectual or cultural history of the development of really what we call the West today, of our liberal institutions, of individualism, even of secularism. And I try to show how all these social institutions are essentially the development, not only, but in a very significant way, of a specific idea. The idea that all people were created in the image of God. The idea that shows up in chapter one of Genesis and has an amazing historical arc in which it informs the civilization that today we live in. So it's an attempt to answer the question how the fact that we were all created equal and that we all have inalienable rights, how this idea is considered self-evident. Because, of course, it wasn't self-evident nearly all of history, nearly any place you look, but it hinges on a specific conception of the human person, a conception that I want to claim is rooted in the idea that we are made in God's image.
Periodically throughout the book, and I really appreciate this, you go out of your way to point out that In God's Image does not single-handedly explain our reality today, but rather that it's a through line and one essential ingredient in how we arrived at our reality today. With that nuance in mind, would you say that the idea of being in God's image is an explanation for our world today or a fruitful line of inquiry to help us make sense of our world today?
In a way, it is an explanation, I would say. I really try to give caveats, as you say, and say that it's conditioned on a lot of things. And it's not anything deterministic, of course. It's not that, like, if you plant the idea of creation in the image of God in some civilization, 3,000 years later, you get the liberal order. No, it's not like that at all. So it's not a sufficient condition in any way, but I would say it is a necessary condition. I don't see a rights discourse and an appreciation of the inherent quality between all people, feminism, etc. We don't see them develop in civilizations that don't have this very basic idea. So I think it is very substantial. It's crucial for this development. And so in a way, you can say my book is also an attempt to answer that very interesting but very scandalous question: why the West? Why is the West and a hegemony as it is? Why is it successful as it is, etc.? And I understand the sensitivity of this question, but I think it's a question that begs an answer and that we need to somehow confront. And this I also try to do in the book.
It's not just scandalous, although it is scandalous, I agree with you. Yeah. It's also timely because for the first time in my adult life, we're questioning the hegemony of the West as China adopts a position of hegemony of its own that we internally are contending with more than I remember in my own lifetime. But I think it's interesting that we should be assuming the hegemony of the West at a juncture when we're actually questioning the hegemony of the West.
I agree with you. And I'll tell you another thing, this question today. We've especially American Jews, but really Jewry in the West, have this conception of a Judeo-Christian tradition. And I know it's criticized from a lot of angles, and some is good criticism. And I know this concept has been abused also for many different purposes. But I think my book also gives us sufficient understanding of this tradition. I think this tradition is real. I think there is a certain pattern or characteristics that you can see through the history of the West that are mutual to Judaism and Christianity, and indeed progress by this idea, the idea of the image of God, which gives us not only equality, of course, of all people, but a certain attitude, a certain conception of individualism, a certain conception of autonomy, a certain conception of mutual relationship between us and the divine, which Judaism and Christianity have. So it's a lot of things that I think we can actually characterize and say there's something here.
Okay, as a skeptic about the idea of Judeo-Christian anything as an adjective, I want to push back on the idea based on how I read your own thesis. I read you to treat the Apostle Paul as a pivot point in this story where he adopts the idea of in God's image and he takes it in a Hellenistic direction, a Greek direction, which is actually very different from where his ancestral Jewish community was taking it. And in that way, I would argue that this idea of in God's image is actually disjunctive in the way that shared ideas can be uniquely disjunctive precisely because they're shared. And when they're interpreted differently, it's actually accentuating difference, not continuity.
I'm not going to deny, obviously, that Christianity is very different from Judaism, of course, right? And Paul indeed is a hinge moment. Paul privatizes and internalizes Judaism, making it universal, right? It makes it individual. And if it's individual, it can be for everyone. So it's universal.
The idea that faith in God between the individual believer and God is the material of the divine human relationship.
And it's not conditioned on ethnicity. You don't need to be a part of specific people. And it's not conditioned on law, right? You don't need to keep kosher, et cetera, et cetera. Right. So no doubt. But look at a certain pattern of, I would say, rebelliousness. In the Jewish tradition, we know the story of Abraham arguing with God. We know the story of Moses trying to convince God not to smite the people of Israel. There is this inner dialogue, which at times is even like tension between people and God. And that, I would say, begins in Genesis, begins with the first Adam that becomes human when he rebels at God and then gets expelled from the Garden of Eden. And that's the beginning of humanity. That's how you become a person, because you're autonomous, because you can decide, you can choose between good and evil, etc., right? And you've got that same like inner rebelliousness in Christianity that keeps reforming and revolutionizing itself. So there's Paul, there's the mendicant orders, there's, of course, Martin Luther and the Protestant Revolution, and there's even secularization, which in a way is another inner Christian revolt. And in every revolt, Christianity has this pattern in which it sheds institutions and laws for the claim of more spirituality.
The rejection of the system to affirm the roots of the system.
Right, as it were, right? That's at least the thesis, right? That's what Paul did to Judaism, reject the law in order to be more spiritual. That's what Martin Luther does to the church, reject the Pope, reject the councils, reject the hierarchy in order to be more religious, more spiritual. And that's what secularism does to Christianity, reject everything, reject the church, reject even Jesus in order to find truth within yourself, in your conscience or in your reason, etc. And I would say that pattern begins in the first chapter of Genesis.
Okay. Before we get to more modern thinkers, I want to talk about this inner tension purely on the Hebraic side. You very convincingly write about the difference between the Hebrew Bible's conception of humanity being in the image of God and the ancient Near Eastern, not just Near Eastern, also Greek pagan notion of humanity's relationship of being in the image of God. And fundamentally, in the Hebrew Bible, as you put it, if I can oversimplify, God cares about us as individuals and as a species. While in the pagan world, God spurns us or disdains us or the gods kick us around. And you cite not only the law, that is the creation of humankind in Genesis, to illustrate this Hebrew idea of in the image of God, but you also talk about the narrative about the law, that is the rabbis who elaborate on these ideas as well as fully integrating into the Judeo-Hebraic system this idea. Within the Hebrew tradition, however, where does the book of Job fit in this distinction between the Hebrew and the pagan? Because to me, in the book of Job, God feels much closer to the pagan gods. He's willing to use Job as a plaything to prove a point. And God is not alone in a purely monotheistic manner in the story of Job. And even more than that, when God makes it up to Job, he does so in a way that feels very much like the commoditization of humanity, very much like the code of Hammurabi. God kills off Job's old family and then simply replaces them with a new one, like interchangeable assets. So is Job a form of a skepticism of ourselves? What's going on?
Well, I would say Job, first of all, is an exception to the rule. And I would say the Bible, obviously, as we all know, carries within it multitudes. It carries within it different voices. Some are diametrically opposed to others. And you know, and even other places, what I write in my book, that the perception of people as the image of God immediately changes laws, right? So if you have in Hammurabi's laws, as you said, you just switch people around. If I killed your son, you kill my son. It's all well and good, even though my son had nothing to do with it. The Bible changes this and says fathers should not be killed for their sons' sins, nor sons for their father's sins. But then you see, even in the Bible itself, that sometimes sons do get killed for their father's sins. Like in the book of Joshua, I'll just give the story of Achan. He's killed with his whole family because he stole something from a battle scene or something. How do we explain that? I mean, doesn't Joshua know the laws of the Bible? But really, the explanation is that, again, there are different voices, and that the vector that the image of God begins goes against the grain. It's the outlier. It's the exception, right? It presents something new to the whole ancient world, to the whole of the ancient Near East, to the whole of Mesopotamia, something new. People are counted as significant. Each and every individual is unique, and people are all equal. These ideas that are all encapsulated within the image of God are new and revolutionary. And so it's not like you present this idea and suddenly everybody get convinced, right? Or you present that idea and, okay, so we'll just organize ourselves in a liberal society. Of course not, right? The default still has a lot of power. And the default is people are sometimes not counted as individuals, and there's a discrimination and there's hierarchy. To fight against that, to change that, takes a lot of time and many other conditions that need to come together. So Job is, I would say, it's an exception. It's there maybe also to remind us what was the world before we got that idea that people are precious enough not to be toyed with.
All right. What is the role of narrative unity in your understanding? Meaning, how does form and function, how do they relate to one another? What one of the qualities of pagan myths is their multiplicity, their plasticity, and their narrative non-linearity. And in the Jewish Hebrew tradition, we have a two-step going on. First, in the law, the Torah, the Hebrew Bible, literature coalesces multiple parallel storylines and generally packages this relationship between humanity and God in a coherent, linear, more or less unitary story. Then, also in the Jewish Hebrew tradition, when we talk about the law, that is when the rabbis and rabbinic literature explains the law to us, we take that original narrative unity of the Hebrew Bible and blow it up, and it mushrooms into 1,000 stories, some of which you cite. So what is the relationship between form and function? How does humanity's relationship with God relate to the manner in which we tell the story about that relationship?
Yeah, I would say it's just a different form of narrative and a different form of conception of what we need to do. The Bible tells us the story of humanity and specifically of a certain people within humanity that have a covenant with God, right? Ze Sefer Toldot Adam, it says in Genesis 5.
The book of the generations of Adam, as we traditionally right. translate that. Yeah,
meaning humanity. Notice that these pagans don't have the history of humanity. It doesn't matter because they come and go. Their history is cyclical in any case, etc. And so that's the Bible. And Chazal, our sages, do something else, right? What they do is try to elaborate a certain code of conduct and ethics in which to live. And what I can say is that the idea of the image of God informs them in a way that each and every opinion counts. And so we always have the minority opinion, and we always have discussion, even for discussion's sake, without a bottom line that we need to act upon. Right. This is what's important to them, the polemics, the enrichment of our culture from dialogue, etc. It's a different project, I would say.
The College Commons podcast belongs to HUC Connect, the online platform for continuing education from the Hebrew Union College. HUC Connect includes webinars, syllabi for community learning, and masterclasses for HUC alumni, with interviews, expert panels, and classroom materials on topics ranging from the arts to civil society, Israel, and much more. Check us out at huc.edu/HUC Connect. Now, back to our interview. Tal Fortgang, in his review, quotes you very approvingly when he summarizes the second half of your argument. He quotes you. He says, "The value of the human subject created through the idea of the image of God," summarizes Persico, "came to demand the repudiation of divine authority." This is like the twist in your argument, that this divine relationship becomes the raw material for the sundering of the divine relationship. What if you and Fortgang, for that matter, are mischaracterizing secular humanism as experienced by most Westerners who work under the assumptions of secular humanism? And here's what I mean. For most of us, I would argue, we don't care if the ideology of secular humanism does or does not repudiate divine authority. Rather, most of us adopt secular humanism as the framework for the social contract, simply because secular humanism is more articulate than any other framework to acknowledge and live with the reality that we human beings have proven incapable of negotiating the place of divine authority in human affairs. So if my characterization is correct about what secular humanists actually believe and care about, is it possible that you're giving secular humanism more weight in the moral realm than it actually deserves?
Well, I mean, what I do in my book is I try to show how secularism really is created, how it's generated, right? I think most people don't understand how far a revolution we have gone through in the last 300 years, right? Even 200 years ago, to be an atheist is to be a completely crazy person. And within 200 years, atheism is not only a legitimate opinion for many people, it is the brave, the worthy, the righteous opinion, because it's, you know, not falling into illusions. There's a whole ethos here. So how did this happen? And what I'm saying is that the same idea, the very same idea that made each and every person unique, special, meaningful, and equal to all others, that made our autonomy so sacred in our eyes, that very same idea, of course, the image of God in us, makes us reject any authority, first the authority of the king, perhaps the authority of the priests in the Reformation, etc., but also the authority of God. And it makes secular humanism because people are less and less tolerant to the idea that there's some great king in the sky telling them what to do. They want to keep their autonomy, right? Now, this connects in a very, very direct way to the second part of your question, because we all live today in a world in which we don't want religious coercion, not only because we've had enough of religious wars, and the third of Europe was killed in a religious war in the 16th century, and everybody thought it's time to let people just believe what they want, but also because we think to coerce people into belief, it just makes no sense. Because this trampling of one's autonomy not only is an affront to their dignity, but also makes for very poor religion. I mean, what God would want believers that are forced into belief? So this view of autonomy as something sacred, as something that brings legitimacy and validity to our decisions, is at the crux both of secular humanism and of our idea of creating a society which is tolerant and which lets people believe and worship as they like.
I love the use of the term the porous self. Tell us what you mean by that, and then contrast it to the other very colorful term, the buffered self.
These are terms that the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor uses, and I use them to explain one of the ways in which we are completely different from our ancient ancestors, or really one of the ways in which we are individuals and they were not individuals, right? A lot of us, we talk constantly of being individuals, and if you go to the humanities, you study about the rise of the modern subject. But really, what is to be an individual? And one of the ways I explain this is to say that in antiquity, at least 2,000 years ago, and in many ways until even a few hundred years ago, we were porous selves. We were selves that were open to the world in the sense that we did think what we call today the objective world was something that is differentiated from us by a wall of our skin or our psyche, right? Forces from the external world were constantly entering us and changing us. And I bring examples of this from ancient myths in which gods insert bravery into people's chests. And we need to understand this not metaphorically. People were brave because a certain god placed bravery in them. Right? This gives us an appreciation of how the self in ancient times, and really, really even in many ways until modernity, was not one thing, was not a command and control center within the brain or within the heart that was a separate monad, totally autonomous, but was porous, was not only influenced by other things, but was intermingled with other things which were a part of them, right? A part of it, a part of the self. Bravery was coming from outside and inserted into ourself, and then we were brave. So this is the ancient understanding of the self, the ancient being of the self. And today we are buffered. Buffered meaning there is a buffer between us and the world. Our division into objective and subjective is one of the most obvious things for us, right? But again, it was not obvious in the past. We think we have thoughts inside and our self is inside and we have feelings inside. And then we have the objective world outside. And that's the way we live. But again, it's a modern way of living which creates an individuality which was not there hundreds and certainly not thousands of years ago.
What did you learn in the course of writing this book that most challenged you or surprised you?
Well, I was first surprised that nobody wrote this book before me, because basically I think this is the most obvious thing. Obviously, chapter one in Genesis influenced the Western civilization, hasn't it? Well, and nobody has written about this idea. And we didn't talk about what is the image of God, but in the Bible, for our sages, the image of God was the human form, was the contours of the human body. I'll bring one example. As you know, in Judaism, we have four ways of executing people, or, you know, at least theoretically. And one of the ways is hanging. And if you hang a person, the Jewish law says, you have to take the body down within a day or even less, right? And why is that? So the sages say, well, you know, it's like a king who has a twin brother, and that brother is a thief. And they catch the thief and they hang him. But if they leave him up there, people going on the road will say, the king is dead. Somebody killed the king. And because of that, humans who are hanged need to be brought down and buried, etc. And you can easily understand that for our sages, what is equivalent, what is similar between humans and the image of God is the human form. Because a person who is hanged, nobody mistakes them for God because they're intelligent or they have reason or they have choice, right? That's not the thing. And I bring other evidence for that in my book. And it's surprising because we are all heirs of the Maimonidean revolution that deleted that idea totally from the Jewish tradition. We all know that God doesn't have a form and not a...
God is incorporeal and our intellect and our soul is the is the reflection. It's a metaphor, according to Maimonides, this idea of a likeness. But even more strongly than what you just said, Tomer, when Maimonides came up with this articulation, he wasn't the first to articulate it, but when he articulated it most influentially, that formulation of the abstract idea of God was part of what made Maimonides not only controversial, but even heretical to some people. So it's even stronger than what you're saying. It was actually an offense to the Jewish sensibility of many Jews, including
Jews in Europe, said, you're not going to tell us that we can't pray to a big king on a chair in the sky. Yeah, no way, right, because lots of good Jews pray that way, and it's perfectly okay. Yeah.
Right. Well, on that note, Tomer Persico, thank you so much for the pleasure of your conversation and for joining us on the College Commentary.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the College Commons Podcast, available wherever you listen to your podcasts. And check out HUC Connect, compelling conversations at the forefront of Jewish learning. For more information about all that HUC Connect has to offer, visit huc.edu/HUC Connect.